Welcome to the CSA Research Podcast, a series of conversations about research taking place at the Center for Study of African Economies at the University of Oxford. I'm Chris Woodruff, Professor of Development Economics at the University of Oxford and a member of CSAE. Today we'll be discussing the research behind the paper Information and Bargaining Through Agents, Experimental Evidence from Mexico's Labor Courts, published in the Review of Economic Studies. Well-functioning courts are essential for health of both financial and real economies, but courts don't function well in most low-income countries. The root causes of poor performance are not really well understood. In this study, we used field experiments with ongoing cases to analyze sources of dysfunction in Mexico's largest labor court. Joining with me today to discuss the project are Joy Sadka, Professor of Research at the Instituto Tecnológico Autónomo de México, or ITAM, in Mexico City. Welcome, Joyce.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much for inviting me.
And Enrique Serra, Professor of Economics at Michigan State University.
Hello.
Welcome, Enrique.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And welcome, everybody. Let's jump right in and start with the research. Joyce, what's the role of labor courts in Mexico?
Labor courts in Mexico are supposed to adjudicate all firing disputes or disputes about fringe benefits or disputes that may be about collective bargaining, not necessarily about individual labor rights. And courts historically were meant to be conciliation and arbitration boards so that they attempted first to conciliate, and then they adjudicate the cases that do not come to any kind of settlement. And it's important to mention that Mexico doesn't have any unemployment insurance. And that means that the severance pay, which is paid to workers who are fired, is basically their only social insurance that will help them possibly, if they get this payment quickly, to search for a job and not go to a worse job. So labor courts are very important for the functioning of the labor market in Mexico.
And we worked with the Mexico City Labor Court. And tell us something about how big that is. How many cases are there in the labor court in Mexico?
It's a big court. It received, at the time we were working on these experiments, it received over 30,000 filings per year. And at the time that it closed its doors, when there was this labor reform that maybe we'll talk about in a little bit, it had over 120,000 case files open, which means not only is it a very big court, it's the biggest labor court in Mexico, it also has a very large backlog, maybe approximately 4 years if it were to finish the cases about as fast as it gets them. But it doesn't finish the cases about as fast as it gets them. So we could think of the backlog as being even more than 4 years.
That sounds like a long time. I think we'll get into that. But can you tell us what the issue the research was trying to address was? That is, what wasn't working? You've already given us an idea there. 4 years of backlog. Sounds like something's not working maybe as well as it should. But what is it you thought wasn't working?
Well, at the time when we started the research, we didn't have a very clear idea about what was not working. And I think one of the things that was important in the research, and perhaps Enrique will talk about that a little bit, is we tried to document a set of facts, a set of stylized facts, if you like. But we documented those first to understand why these cases were not settling. And one important thing that I'd like to say is from the beginning, we compared Mexico to other countries. Mexico, as you probably know, is part of the OECD. So we compared Mexico to OECD countries, but we also looked at some countries in Latin America, like Chile, perhaps Brazil, and we looked at the difference in settlement rates. And we looked at the US as well and compared. And what we found is that Mexico had lower settlement rates than a lot of other countries, in spite of two things that are true about the vast majority of the labor lawsuits, which is they're not very high quantity. And because of how the labor law is structured in Mexico, they are not legally very sophisticated or very complicated. And this would tell us from the point of view of economic theory on bargaining that most of these lawsuits should come to a settlement immediately or very early in the process. And we did not find that empirically. So that, I think, was like the starting point for this research.
And when you say they aren't very big quantitatively, you mean the size of the case, not the number of cases. We've already talked about the number of cases. So this is the size of the cases.
That's right.
What is a typical case?
A typical case is a worker who probably earns about $500 to $700 per month, who has worked about 18 months and is probably in their late 20s or early 30s or mid 30s, you know, around that range between 28 and 35, 36, and probably is being fired for one of two reasons. Either there wasn't a good match between the worker and the firm to begin with, and so that worker really wasn't very productive in that job. And another very important reason for workers to be fired is really the firm is not doing very well financially, market conditions, or the firm is just not very productive. We have to remember that Mexico has a very large informal sector, and it also has a very large proportion of small and, you know, medium, but kind of on the small side firms that don't grow much. And part of the reason they don't grow much is the labor law itself, because severance pay is a lot for a firm that has hired a worker for a short period of time and needs to get rid of that worker. A lot of firms don't want to formalize even their employment relationships to avoid this cost of firing. There are, of course, other factors, macroeconomic factors, factors that have to do with credit, but labor law rigidities have something to do with the configuration of firms in Mexico.
Right. Okay. So, Enrique, can you talk us through the design of the project? I mean, so first of all, Joyce says we didn't really know at the beginning what the problem was. So how did you think about the design at the beginning of the project to try to figure out what is it that the research should try to uncover and unpack about what the problems were?
So this was a project where we had a lot of help from the government partner. And we started by asking plaintiffs and defendants to a case many things. Their beliefs about winning, what is the likelihood that you think you're going to win this case? These were cases that had already started. And if so, you think you're going to win, how much are you going to win and how long would it take? So we started asking people about their expectations. And then we started also asking people about their own lawsuit, the content of their own lawsuit. Have they asked for extra hours that were unpaid or vacations that were not taken? And then we realized that this environment was one where parties were overconfident. They all thought plaintiffs and defendants are going to win this case. The probabilities of winning a given case summed to 1.5. And also where they had very little information, not only about what the law mandated they should entitle them to, but also about their own lawsuit. They half of the workers didn't know what was written in their own lawsuit. So there was an environment where information was scarce and where parties seemed to be overconfident in the likelihood of winning. And we learned that just by asking, like almost like anthropologists, went there and asked people there to find out what they were thinking. That's the way we started.
Can you say something about the design then? How did you then come up with the design for the project?
Yes. So once we established that information seemed to be a problem, we then looked at the literature, the theory literature, and several strands of literature suggested that informational problems and overconfidence could lead to low settlement, to the breakdown of bargaining. So there was a happy coincidence that theory was clear on what can cause the breakdown of bargaining. And also our empirical work suggested that indeed those conditions seem to be present there. And the solution, the theory solution is in both cases in overconfidence and asymmetric information, well, let's try to provide information that is objective and trustworthy. And so that's what we did. Let's say We designed an experiment. We wanted to provide information as objective as possible and as useful as possible. So we designed what we call the calculator, which is just a machine learning prediction algorithm for predicting case outcomes of cases that have been closed but are similar to yours. For each person, we had a predictive, three quantities predicted: likelihood of winning, amount of winning conditional on how long it would take, and we also had an estimate of how long it would take. And we designed an experiment where to certain parties to a conflict, plaintiffs and defendants, we gave this information. It was condensed in one sheet. It was just before the hearing. And to some other parties, randomly, we didn't give this information. That was the main design.
Can I just ask, it sounds like every case must be different. And so you've taken the characteristics of the case and you've come up with a number that says here's what you'll win. How do workers react to that? I mean, how do the parties react to that? They must think, wait, I know what my case is. You're giving me a number. Can you say something about where the number comes from? And then also kind of how you take into account the fact that workers know something about their case.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So the cases were taken from historical case files, so cases that have been already closed. We try to make this sample as representative of previous cases, but we have like 5,000 of those closed cases, historical cases. And then the estimates map characteristics of those cases, like which industry did the worker work in, the tenure of the worker, the salary of the worker. And these last two characteristics, for example, are very important for severance because severance involves a formula that is a function of tenure and salary. So with these characteristics, we estimated predictive models on the historical data set, what we call the calculator. And then we provided this information, this predictive information for each case, ongoing case. We took these covariates, salary, tenure, industry, and others, and then predicted outcomes using those cases covariates. Now, you're right that not all cases are the same. And so we were very careful to tell workers and plaintiffs and defendants that these were averages of previous cases, closed cases, and that it didn't exactly predict their own case, but at least they were precise on average. We also provided some information of what the law mandates, not just the statistical prediction, to make sure they had the complete big picture, what the law mandates and what our model predicts. But we're careful to say that these predictions have error.
Great. So, and then what did we find? What, can you summarize that the outcomes of the intervention?
Yeah. So we, as Joyce was saying at the beginning, we found that one of the big problems of the court was backlog, and that this backlog was growing with time. Even though these trials take years, settlement rates were low. And so we conjecture that misinformation and overconfidence or asymmetric information may be part of the reason why settlement rates were low. So we provide this information. And so there were a couple of main outcomes. First, we wanted to see if this information changed expectations. So if we tell somebody, look, Chris, historically, cases like yours have won with 37% probability and have won $500 after 4 years of trial. If we tell you that, we want to see if your beliefs about winning the case and how much you would win change. That was the first thing we looked at. And we find that indeed it changed, not all the way to the prediction, but some of the way towards the prediction. So people didn't exactly believe what we said, but it tended to move in the right direction, in the direction of the model. Second, we said, well, we seem to be changing beliefs. Now, do they settle more? Which was our initial concern. And indeed, we found that on the day they received information, settlement almost doubled from 6% to 11 percentage points on the same day. And so that was encouraging for us because it proved that giving objective information, predictive information, personalized information did help to increase settlement. And that's what we wanted.
So I can imagine the kind of speeding up settlement. You've told me this, I've gotten this, I was going to settle anyway, but you know, because you gave this information and you sort of get my attention on the idea of settling, I do it today. Is there a longer term effect?
Yes. So this is very interesting. You may wonder, maybe this information just speeds up settlement, but we are not changing the total number of cases that settle at the end of the day, at the end of the years. And that's not what we find. We were able to follow these cases 4 years after treatment. It was a big effort of following cases. And we found that the treatment effect was constant for all these 4 years. That is, we are not just speeding up settlement, but causing new settlements that wouldn't happen without the information. I like this result because it kind of validates these theories of information and bargaining. Information matters for settlement, and it matters in the long run. Now, Chris, I don't know. I would like to mention one of my favorite results of the paper. So far, I've said on average what were the effects. But one of the interesting things that we found is that I was not expecting to find this, is that information only matters when it is given directly to the worker. When I give the information to the worker's lawyer, nothing happens. There's no effect on settlement. And we were very impressed by this result. It could seem, this is consistent with a story where the lawyer doesn't want to transmit this information to his client, and suggestive of a moral hazard problem from the lawyer's side.
Now I get the title. That's the bargaining through agents.
Exactly. That was a good title. I think you came up with it, Chris.
So, Joyce, let me turn back to you. We found a paper along the way, written by some lawyers, that said, you know, sometime back in the 1920s, law and medicine reached a fork in the road, and medicine went one way towards doing all RCTs, and law went another way and never did an RCT for as long as the eye could see. And there are really very few randomized control trials in legal proceedings, even in sort of arbitration proceedings, much less in an active court. So engaging with live cases and doing an intervention, a randomized intervention with live cases, is really quite a rare thing. Can you say something about how that came about? How I'm going to say you were able to negotiate that with the court?
Well, it started with building a relationship, right, with the courts in general. But many years before we started this experiment, I had used the Mexican transparency law, which is a very powerful legislation that says that all case files that are no longer subject to appeal are public information, and the courts have to provide this information in public versions. But the courts couldn't, because they didn't have the personnel or the technology to produce these public versions of the lawsuits. And the law allows for researchers, just like us, to go to the courts and sign an agreement where we promise to keep the personal data confidential or not use the personal data and have access to the case files. And so nobody had done this, and I did it. And for quite a few years, I just extracted a lot of data because there was a lot to study descriptively. But by creating a relationship with several of the courts, these courts had worries about the rate of settlement or the rate of cases being reverted on appeal or corruption in their notifications and so on. And because of all these worries, there was a chance to design research that would answer a policy question that the court had, but at the same time have an academic upside or academic value. So in general, that was the approach. Now, the Mexico City Labor Court is a particularly interesting case because we didn't look for them, they looked for us. They knew that I was doing work that had to do with monitoring notifiers who deliver summons and who are highly corrupt in Mexico. And I was doing work on this in Mexico State, which is nearby. And a new president of the labor court, of the Mexico City Labor Court, literally sent somebody there to find me and bring me to an interview with her because she was worried, among other things, about the low settlement rate, about having invested in conciliators and trained them, but not having people going to those conciliators in the hearings and asking to settle. and other things. She was also worried about corruption among the notifiers and other things. But she actually basically called us. We didn't call her. So that gave us a lot of leverage because there was a clear interest from the court to work with us.
And did the court then just jump right to an RCT? How did that conversation come about?
No, actually, the courts rarely will jump directly to an RCT. So maybe one of the things that's different between medicine and law is that even though in medicine sometimes the studies have, small numbers of people and maybe, econometricians might criticize some of the medical studies, but the idea that you have to have the control group and the intervention or intervention groups is clear in general to somebody who's in medicine. It's not that clear to someone who is in law. So you kind of have to explain to these institutions that if they just try everything at the same time to try and improve what's happening, they will never know what worked. And because these policies eventually will be costly to them if they want to implement them on a scaled, full scale, they really need these RCTs because otherwise they won't know what to fight for in their budget and where to put their scarce resources. And so we explained this to the head of the labor court. Actually, Enrique and I had meetings with the head of the labor court to explain this. And eventually, years later, she attended a workshop at Berkeley where there were classes for some of the policymakers, top policymakers from different countries. And so I think that in this case, this lesson was really internalized by the leadership of the court. And it was a happy coincidence. They had needs. They were open. We explained things to them and we also built a relationship with them. And it ended up being very fruitful for both sides.
And I realize here, looking back at my introductory script that I read, Joyce, I really failed to introduce who you are in the sense that you have both an economics degree and a law degree, and while you're affiliated with the economics department at ETHOM, you're actually head of the law school. So does the how much does that help in these conversations to be? I mean, ETHOM is certainly one of the best law schools in Mexico. How much does it help to have, the entry point of ETHOM's law school when you're engaged in these conversations?
It's very helpful. ETAM is very well known as the top economic school, and it started as an economic school, but it has a very good law school that started also some 45 years ago. What's very important is that ETAM signs these confidentiality agreements with the researcher. So we agree that we will put into place all the procedures to make sure that we take the right care of the personal data that's in these case files. But ETAM is also willing to put its name on the line with us, which I think is very important because, just one individual showing up and saying, give me these thousands of case files, it just doesn't sound like any court would be willing to do it. So I think that there's a very important sort of backing from there. And also, another thing that's been very important for our work, and Enrique will agree with me, is that ETAM has great students. And so a lot of our work has also gone through working with students who do things that are as simple as coding data, although that's not as simple as one might think, to working on econometrics for the papers, to helping to design the operational details of the experiment, running the experiment, collecting surveys, and really, our work has benefited greatly from the fact that ETAM filters students, and we have these great students, and who many of them have later gone on to postgraduate work and PhDs, and some of them are out there running their own experiments as we speak.
So I want to get into sort of what the impact of the research was. And so Mexico passed the new labor law in 2019. The paper was published in 2024. So I can do grander causality and say the paper publishing must not have had any effect on the labor law. But tell us about how the research was useful in the discussions on the labor law.
It's true that the paper was published 4.5 years after the labor law came out, but you have to remember that pipelines are long in our profession. And we started these experiments in 2016. And actually, the last of the experiments that we report on in the paper was run between the summer of 2017 and the fall of 2019. So, in fact, we already had some results at the time that the labor law was being discussed. So, the labor law was reformed for a series of reasons. Some of them were internal to Mexico, but many were external, and they had to do with free trade agreements in general. There were other trade agreements, but the biggest that made the difference was the USMCA. And when Mexico was trying to pass the labor law in order to pass the revision of the treaty and ratify the treaty, I worked on a small proposal in March of 2018, and it was submitted. I worked with the head of the labor court, and we submitted a proposal for the labor law in March of 2018, but it didn't pass. Because the government was changing, the PRI was going to lose power, and a new left-wing party for the first time was going to take power in Mexico. And when that happened, the president of the labor court, the same person who had sent people to call me from Mexico State to come work with her in the labor court, started a group of a legislative group, basically. And this legislative group met every week from May of 2018 to November of 2018. And in this group, there were some academics, very few, I was one of them. There were people from international organizations, like the ILO, like the Inter-American Development Bank. There were people from unions, there were people from government positions, Secretary of Labor from the state, Undersecretary of Labor from the Federation. Those kinds of people. And in those meetings, I had the opportunity to show preliminary results from our experiments. And that led them to understand that the worker himself or herself being in the conciliation hearing was very important, following what Enrique just told us about a short while ago. And it led them to understand that making it compulsory for the parties to meet at least once was very important. And eventually, what happened after showing them all these results is that they asked me to help to put together the procedure that would be applied. So, literally, what happened is that the 2019 labor law, which is still valid in Mexico, essentially codifies that last experiment that we report on in the paper, which was pre-lawsuit conciliation, not intervening in the cases that were already filed, but intervening with workers who had a firing dispute but had not yet hired a lawyer. And so that got codified into the law, and that has opened a lot of doors for us to have policy influence, but also to build infrastructure that will allow us in the future to do research without having to collect data from paper files and take so long to get results from our experiments.
Meaning digitized data.
That's right. I'm now collaborating on a couple of large technical assistance projects, and we've kind of moved into creating case management, online case management systems for the conciliation centers and then also for the labor courts. And the idea is that we're hoping to move to a paperless system where there's a lot of data online, and therefore the future calculators that could be calibrated may be even more exact or less inexact, if we follow what Enrique said, than ours was, because we will now have access to a lot more data. And this will allow parties to have more information and make better decisions.
One of the things then that came out of the law was a pre-suit conciliation phase. And a new institution, which is the Conciliation Center, again, one in every state. So there's a Conciliation Center in Mexico City. And we can talk a little bit about the work that we're beginning to do at the Conciliation Center in Mexico City. But I want to also point out then that it also meant that they took the courts themselves and moved them from a set of courts under the Labor Ministry to a new set of courts under the judiciary. So while the Mexico City Labor Court that we work with carries on with the cases that had already been filed, once those cases are finished 6 or 8 years from now, that court will disappear, and the new court is there. So in a sense, there's an opportunity here. Enrique, I want to ask you about this. We had 4 years, at least 4 years of backlog in the Mexico City Labor Courts, and in a sense, poof, it's all gone. We're starting afresh with new labor courts that have this pre-conciliation phase before them. Maybe the chance for the labor courts not to get so much of a backlog. But is that a reality? And how do we prevent the new courts from becoming as clogged and having as long a backlog as the old courts had?
So I think the objective of the conciliation centers is precisely to aid parties to reach an agreement before filing a lawsuit. And so we think many of these disputes could be solved before reaching this costly stage of involving lawyers, courts, and judges. We are starting to work with the conciliation center in Mexico City, which receives hundreds of parties with their disputes per day. And we're trying to work with them to facilitate the bargaining. And this is work in progress by providing information, by helping them focus on getting an agreement instead of being angry. I think there's many opportunities here, given the amount, just the sheer amount of cases we're dealing with, to help them settle, and only those that cannot agree using words would be able to go to the next stage and get a lawyer. The other thing that's interesting here is I told you that one of the last results of the paper was that it seems that lawyers get in the way of a good settlement because they may have different incentives than the client. And so trying to intervene before they get a lawyer may be a good way to facilitate agreement. That's a second promise and good thing about working with parties before they make a lawsuit. So I think there's a lot of potential here.
Great. So good luck to us with the ongoing research to try to prevent that backlog rebuilding in the new labor courts. So I want to close with a brief discussion of the logistics of what we're doing. Let me say, on the podcast, you can't see me, but I've got a smile on my face, and I do whenever I think about this project because Enrique and Joyce run teams of many, many research assistants working in the courts and the Conciliation Center at ETAM. I come up with a few words on the title and get my name on the paper. So this is for me, this has been a fantastic collaboration. But I know that the amount of work that goes on in the ground is enormous. And so let me start with you, Joyce. Can you describe the operation kind of at the maybe at the court, but really, maybe let's just jump to the operation at the Conciliation Center and what your team is there and what they do at the Conciliation Center.
So currently, we have a team of people who work as technical assistants for the use of this online conciliation case management system. However, they're already doing work such as they've conducted focus groups with the conciliators, interviews with the conciliators. They've helped us to do observation of how workers stand in line, how they enter the conciliation center to sort of study whether we would have an information booth outside the door or right on the inside where we would place these booths. And eventually, when we start this experiment, we will probably have at least 20 individuals who will all be either lawyers or economists. More than half of them will be people who have specialized with us over some years, and they already have their degrees in law and maybe a master's degree. We have several now that already have master's degrees in labor law who are working with us. But we'll also have some younger students from the last semester, maybe of their economics degree, who are interested in development and interested in empirical analysis of legal issues, and they're interested in RCTs. And they will be there giving information to people, supervising that the conciliators operate whatever that we need them to operate at the beginning of a hearing, like having the parties watch a video. We'll have some tablets where they will be able to watch those videos and so on. What's most difficult in this kind of implementation, in my opinion, is making sure that the experiment is clean. And what's very important is making sure that every single enumerator, interviewer, operational personnel, from the youngest to the oldest, from the ones that know lots about economics and others that know little about economics but more about law, all understand how the experiment has to be run, what not to do so that you don't mess up the control and the intervention groups. And I think also they need to be inspired because this is a difficult job to do. You meet resistance, even if the conciliation center itself is willing to work with you. It has 90 conciliators, and some of them will be resistant to the work. Some of the parties may be resistant. You need to understand the treatment of the personal and confidential data. So it's quite a complicated job to do, and I think that they need to be motivated and understand what the sort of mission is. And that means that the researchers have to be there with them. And we can't sort of run this by remote control. And that, I think, is one of the roles that I have, is making sure that this runs in a way that corresponds to the design of the experiment. I think that's
Right.
what's very difficult to do.
And then when we get the data from the experiment, it all comes back to ETAM, to the team of researchers there. And Enrique, maybe you can just give us a brief description of kind of what you kind of manage that team quite a lot, and what the work is, and how that operation works.
Yes, sure. Let me say that. But let me say something very quickly before that. Joyce is, I mean, it's a special person. I think if it weren't for Joyce, this would be hard to do. And the communication between Joyce, the team of Joyce, and the leaders at the labor courts is essential to get the support the research needs, but also to translate the research output to policy. And this is one of the most successful projects I've been, just because of that link. In terms of the research, let me call it the econometrics team, we have very good students working with us. Many of them are interested and have gone to do PhDs in economics. And I see my job as first motivating them, as Joyce said, explaining what we're doing, and then coaching them on how to do the analysis. But they are much, much better at coding than me now. I'm getting scared. But this is a great, great set of young people embarking on research. And it just very, for me, it's a pleasure to work with them. My job is basically guiding them. What are the main questions? What analysis do we need to answer the questions? What are the challenges? It's very smooth. I mean, they're already very good.
Great. Just to echo the point that you made there, Enrique, which was what I was going to close with, which is one of the things that I think it really shows is a pathway to impact, which is not about publishing a paper and having policymakers read the paper, but about sort of continuous engagement with the policy process. And that is, I think, where Joyce and especially, I think, the connection to the law school, the fact that you're a lawyer, the fact that you can talk to people on that level, and that you have more energy than the whole team put together to be able to do it, is really kind of instrumental in making the project as successful from a policy perspective as it has been. So look, I want to just say, we'll close up here, but just say thank you to both of you, to Joyce and to Enrique, for joining me in the discussion.
It's been a pleasure. Sharing the research is very enjoyable. After all the effort it takes to produce it, it's just a joy. And working with you too was also very, very nice for me.
Yes, I wanted to say thank you so much, and that Chris does a lot more than put the words in the title. And really, I think we have had a very fruitful relationship, not only with the courts, ETAM, the law school, the economics department, the students, but we've also had a very fruitful relationship working with each other. And I think that complementing each other as co-authors is part of the secret of being able to, go the whole 10 miles and get to where we've been able to get right now. So I think
Or
we've
the
been
whole 10
lucky enough.
years.
Yeah, exactly. Or the 10 years. Thank you very much, Chris. It's been fun.
You.
Thank you. And thank everyone for listening to the CSAE Research Podcast. We hope you'll join us again next time. To listen to more episodes from the series, go to the CSAE website.